This is an example of speech.
All our history of broiling.
Welcome to Tell Me What to Think, a free from oversight and free of charge, thoughtfully improvised, expletive deleted, details expanded, whistle blow hard, evergreen topical heatwave of a weekly conversation turned podcast, in which we discuss politics, global affairs, current events, music, literature, social media, and anything else that bubbles up from the unmoderated comment sections in our brains. We urge you to join us and tell us what you think. You can contact us at tmwttpod@gmail.com. I'm Peter Albro. You can contact me on Twitter at @bloatednemesis. And I have with me, as always and forever, Charles Minnick, who is on Twitter at @green_weird, which is WYRD. This episode, we have weak thoughts about the Iran deal. Before the White House's announcements about the Iran deal, though we were pretty much right, so it really doesn't change the discussion. A deep dive into Charles's thoughts on information warfare and social media that takes some appropriate tangents into the 2018 midterms and police violence. A grown-up book report of Johnny Cash, I See a Darkness, a graphic novel by Reinhard Kleist, and closing thoughts about Southeast Wisconsin's own speaker problems. And I don't mean Paul Ryan. Prepare to get righteous and reactionary. This is Tell Me What to Think. Time to get on our soap pod and tell you what to think. Now, for some weak thoughts.
In Uganda, the poor crack baby. In Atlanta, the continent. The trash right knees and trans Indonesia. Housemaid from those who are never on the airwaves.
All right, and welcome to Tell Me What to Think. Bloody war. Charles with me as always. We can find us on Twitter at @bloatednemesis and Charles on Twitter at @green_weird. And you can email the podcast at tmwttpod@gmail.com. And make sure to review and comment and like.
And subscribe and everything else.
Charles, how are you doing?
I'm okay. The weather's been pretty good here. So I've got all my roses planted, I think. I hope.
And we're recording in the same room for probably the first time doing
ever.
This podcast. Yeah. All right. So we had a request to talk about the Armenian change in government recently. They call it the Velvet Revolution. A request from our esteemed legal advisor, consultant person, Dave. So, Charles, what's going on there?
Well, it sounds like the eventual end of any entirely corrupt oligarch. He has been kicked out of office due to his patronage network. Like, if he's been ruling the country with an iron fist. He was president, and then he reached the term limit, and then, you know, organized his own political movement to change to a parliamentary democracy and made himself prime minister to get around those term limits, and the people apparently had had enough. And basically the most famous protester, the most famous dissident, has been able to take advantage of this popular will to make himself prime minister now. Geopolitically, it's not going to matter too much, except for disrupting the former president's patronage networks.
Which is kind of an explicit goal.
Right.
He talks about bringing down the oligarchy. So let's get some names down.
I'm sorry for not saying them, because I didn't want to butcher them too badly.
It's tough for
I speak a few Americans. Languages, but this is difficult.
So, Nicole Pashinyan is the opposition leader who, by the prime minister's own parliament, was voted into power this
right.
week after they losing were, a similar vote a week before.
Right, they were trying to stymie his accession to the prime prime minister office.
And, what's the name of the...
president.
Serge Sargsyan. Serge Sargsyan was the president for a while, reached his term limit.
Made his wife vice president.
And they changed the... it's like Zimbabwean. And they... he tried to change the government into a kind of more parliamentary, where they have a prime minister in power, and then he went from presidency to that position. And so, yeah, it's pretty like explicit upper level power grab. It's kind of nice hearing it get called out as bullshit pretty immediately,
resoundingly.
And so, you know, that's, I don't know, I kind of envy that a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. Maybe they have a freer media atmosphere.
Actually, there was, so I was telling you, I read a few articles about this before the show, and there's an Al Jazeera, like, opinion piece, and the guy writing it who was moved to Armenia to be in their, at the American University there, and... his wife was, like, a photojournalist, kind of covering it, but, like, also, like, involved in the protests.
More advocacy journalism.
She showed off getting hit by, like, a shock grenade, like, the...
wow.
It did to her leg. Bruised it or something. Anyways, he talked about in the article about having to smuggle news and reports and pictures of the protests and stuff.
Wow.
To media people. Like, or out of the country, or maybe to whatever...
I assume that...
but so I'm guessing it's not a freer media.
Yeah, I guess he's probably... well, he's a strong man in Russia's sphere of influence, so he probably has pretty tight control over the internet. For whatever internet access they have. Because it's a landlocked country in the Caucasus, right?
Mm-hmm. What's it? It's bordered by Russia, Iran, and Azerbaijan.
And Georgia? Is it border Georgia?
We're going to have to go to the map.
Let's go to the map.
Download. Oh, yeah, you're right. Georgia, little teeny bit of Russia there.
Iran and Turkey.
Yeah, and Turkey. That's the big one I forgot, though.
Yeah.
But
they've had an ongoing economic problem with Turkey for at least the last decade.
Is that because they, like... made some proclamation about the genocide or anything?
Did yeah,
like
well, there's kind of... just, shall we say, lingering ethnic tensions.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that.
Because their Armenians also had long-term engagements with Azerbaijan next door, which is mostly Muslim.
Oh, okay.
And Armenia is mostly Christian.
Okay, yeah. There's a... Armenians are fairly... I would say a strong population in this country of, you know, they strongly identify.
Yeah, there's a strong diaspora.
Where I'm from in Racine had like Armenian Fest. The Armenian Church was, you know, had a lot of people in it.
Crazy. It's not that big of a country.
No, I just, it seems like there's a strong national identity.
Yeah.
With them.
They've gone through things together. I've built collective identity.
Okay, so what to keep an eye on with this kind of new guy, his cabinet. He said they're going to maintain strong ties with Russia, which they'd be stupid not to, I would argue.
Right.
You're just too little and they're too big to be making waves.
Yeah, right. And they have Georgia next door. I'd say the thing is to see when he goes to Russia first. And then he also might take this opportunity to maybe tamp down the problems with Azerbaijan and Turkey. Which would improve them economically, just because they're not.
I haven't heard of any comments not having, you know. I don't get, like... status updates on my phone about Armenia. politics.
Haven't made it a topic in Google News.
But some of the articles that I read pointed out how he hasn't taken much in the way of policy stands beyond some domestic stuff, but I don't think there was anything that talked about foreign.
Okay, so that could be a problem.
He hasn't commented at all, but it doesn't seem like it's been a strong part of his messaging, so...
So either...
But I'm going to argue that might mean he's leaving himself leeway to do whatever, to just be flexible in getting to a good outcome.
Right, or he suffers from the progressive problem that we've seen here in the United States, where progressives, though they may have great domestic policies, don't really have any coherent just foreign policy. Yeah. Or, as you could say, he's just a blank slate waiting for whatever...
Yeah.
Hmm. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. All right, let's move to the other side of the world, Iran. 200 miles away or something.
Next door.
Well, I mean, mostly, most things happen in Tehran.
Right, in the southern part. That's where the most of the population is.
Do they have, wait, how does that work in Iran? Is it kind of like, so most of the money and population's in the south, but their capital's kind of...
In the north.
Is it because of the
Silk Route.
Is it kind of like an economically prosperous city?
Well, the country itself could be relatively economically prosperous. Look at all those mountains.
Well, yeah.
Tehran, correct me if I'm wrong, but was there because of the Silk Road. That's like a route between, the Mediterranean and Central Asia.
Yeah. I mean, it's right there on the south of the Caspian Sea. It's a crossroads of the world.
Yeah.
It even looks like it kind of has some benefits of being near the sea, but there's, mountains in between it and the sea, and I'm guessing that was more defensible from these other places creeping in on them over water.
Right. Well, that's why Persia's been, always had a strong geopolitical strategic advantage.
So, in... 4 days?
4 days now.
The Iran deal has to be recertified by all parties, I assume.
Yeah. But it's basically the United States.
Yes. And the whims of our God Emperor. So, all signs point to...
No. He's probably not going to do it. Especially with... What is it? Isn't it the same day that the embassy in Jerusalem is going to be opened? Yeah. The same day, that Sabbath.
That's weird.
Well, it's planned.
Yes.
Well, it's Kushner, trying to get the political optics. It's on they're opening it on Saturday, so everybody in Israel is going to have the day off. They're going to pack that area around what is now the American embassy with as many people as they possibly can to make it look huge, like some kind of momentous event.
Yeah, and then if you did some sort of announcing of, fuck Iran, we're pulling out of this deal on the same day. That seems to be stoking the flames of war in Israel more so than even here.
Well, yeah.
If we can get them, they're all in.
Well, yeah, because it's... I think Kushner and Mohammed bin Salman, perhaps realized that they couldn't necessarily do what Bush and Cheney did as well. Push the United States into a war that makes literally no sense. Yeah. But if Israel is involved in a war, America will
defend Israeli interests.
Yeah.
You have both political parties on that.
Uh-huh. You're getting a smaller faction you're using leverage of a smaller faction against a larger faction.
Do you think someone that I would assume would be, but I don't know this for sure, against going into Iran, like, say, Chuck Schumer... Right now, or if you would have asked him a year ago.
I think he's almost in favor of it. You're picking the wrong Democrat.
I mean, I know he's, he's a big pro-Israeli, but there's a sizable portion of Israelis that don't want to go to war in Iran, right?
I assume.
It's not like...
I mean, their atmosphere has gotten... Their Overton window is way further right than ours, even.
Well, yeah, and I think they see... From what I've picked up, they're fairly polarized.
Yeah, politically.
And the partisans.
Well, they've had, communist kibbutzes there, and now they're a far right-wing near dictatorship. Yeah, there's some issues.
okay, fine. Maybe not Chuck Schumer, but,
Bernie Sanders. He came out against the violence in Gaza.
Okay, so we'll see if he's a good example. But then let's say we flash forward, Israel is like just all in on it. Mm-hmm. All in on a war with Iran. There's
Hezbollah.
Things happening. Mm-hmm. And the kind of, well, I didn't want to start it, but now I'll defend it type attitude starts popping up amongst Democrats.
Yeah.
And at least anti-war Republicans. Like, how many would
change? Vote against it?
No, vote for it at that point.
Rand Paul would vote for it, I guarantee.
He'd be an easy turn.
Yep. I'm not sure Bernie would. I'm not even sure what consists of an anti-war, like, caucus in the Senate right now. Like, because Warren, Baldwin, a lot of them voted for that extra defense author, for money from that defense authorization. And, I mean, maybe you could argue that was, you know, tied to wages and benefits for soldiers, but it's not for the VA, so it's tough to, yeah.
I have a kind of practical political explanation for that, which is just, because that's the spending bill, right? Like, it was part of a bigger...
I thought it was just I'm pretty sure that was just this year's National Defense Authorization Act, right?
Okay, but if I recall, there was negotiations surrounding that, and then that big, just the kind of everything spending bill that had, like, sustained, it did, like, no spending cuts to tons of social programs for a couple years.
That is most worthless bargain to make. I'm sorry.
But I'm saying, I think they're both going at it. All of the, like, big, like, social hot-button things haven't been really decided. Like, people are like, do the Dream Act thing, and it just nothing happened either way.
Right. Nobody
which kind of makes it bad. But you know what I mean? Like, they didn't pass some sort of horribly anti-immigrant bill either. They didn't do what Tom Cotton would have wanted. And they didn't do what Dick Durbin wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like they just, it was like Paul Ryan, some of the leadership, and then whoever on the other side, Pelosi and maybe Schumer, you know, just sort of like ironed out, like, all right, let's just look at the money. What guys do you want this amount of spending? We want this amount of spending. Said to the Republicans, don't cut this, and we'll give you something. The Republicans said, well, give us this, like, $20 billion increase to the wall. And they're like, how about we just all raise the defense spending a little bit? Win-win. No one loses in that one.
It's not a good bargain, though.
I just think the logic behind it is it just only extends that far.
Yeah. I mean, I understand. It's like, they're really, really, really trying not to move anything, though. And in some ways, that bothers me. Because we can almost all acknowledge that there are some flaws with what's happening. And not moving anything is not improving anything. I mean, we're not making things worse, but at this point, what is worse?
Are you just talking about generally?
Like, for instance, healthcare-wise.
Okay.
And even in immigration. Like, not doing anything is letting Trump run rampant. Now they're going to start separating families at the border?
So let's look at immigration, though. I mean, it seems like you just have two groups that are stuck and they're not moving.
Yeah, well, like, the Republicans aren't, their baseline of negotiating position seems to be, like, zero immigration, except for meritocracy.
What's that even going to mean? They haven't.
That means rich people can get into the country, and they can almost certainly buy their way in. But the people who are desperate are not going to have any refuge here in the land of the Statue of Liberty.
And so that's unacceptable.
That is a base to progressives or liberals, notionally Democrats, centrist Republicans. Like Christian, like the evangelists should definitely be against that, right?
I mean, the evangelists aren't against paying hush money to a porn star that you fucked while your wife was just giving birth to your son.
Among other porn stars that may or may not have also been paid. Thanks for that, Giuliani. We'll get to that later.
Purview of totally okay.
So, yeah, I guess all bets are off.
I don't think they have any of the, and I don't mean like as individuals and pastors.
Mm-hmm.
I think they question their votes, but they, I think, a lot of those churches in like Texas, or a lot of the places holding people that can't be touched are churches, even some evangelical.
Yeah.
In, you know, Florida and California and, you know.
Everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, probably actually in the north.
And in Wisconsin, especially Wisconsin.
Immigration, it's hard to get out of that mindset, which is why it's so effective for Trump of the wall. That you think of immigration, yeah, they probably do have higher numbers in Texas or something, but is that even because they're geographically, at this point, because they're geographically close to Mexico, or just that it did matter at one point, so people go towards populations that are more like where they're from or have actual family there?
I think it's just usually kinship ties, based on my study of immigration. Like, people go to where their family and their like the people from their village are. Yeah. So, which is why you have, like, Iowa, I think, is just becoming even more Hispanic, and Georgia, and even Wisconsin, because there's need for seasonal workers.
Yeah, yeah, and I think at this point, you just go wherever. It's not that hard to, it's not that much of a difference if you're coming to America to go to Texas or Wisconsin, in terms of it being close to where you're from.
Right, because we
a
have...
a plane ride, it's a, you know...
We have an interstate system, so...
Yeah.
It's not like you're walking
and, you know,
for
gas
weeks
to get up there until you get to your people.
Greyhound.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like nothing.
I mean, except for, what was that, St. Petersburg or Tampa? Where that... In Florida, like, apparently immigration officials are now, like, they were camping in a bus terminal and asking people as they're getting on the bus to see their papers.
Yeah. Well.
So yeah, there are real problems with immigration and its enforcement. Admittedly, the extreme position of abolish ICE stands in almost direct contravention to no immigrants and get them out of my country.
Yeah.
I don't know how do you rectify that, so...
Yeah, I mean, well... I feel like that kind of, like, middle-of-the-ground bills that were proposed... Like, I sort of went earlier, I said Dick Durbin on the other side, but I don't think he even is the extreme position on it at all.
No, he's like a...
But he was just... It was extreme. This is a good example, the Overton window. It becomes extreme to accept the previously thought of middle ground.
Like, it wasn't it Bush and, like, was it Bush or Clinton who came up with that initial compromise?
That might have been Bush. I remember Bush had a big failed immigration push.
But it enabled Clinton. Didn't Clinton reform immigration in the 90s? Like, 96 seems to stand out. Like, he compromised with Newt Gingrich. Like, yes, we have to allow in, transitory workers. Yes, we'll do the, guest worker program. And yes, we'll do the, educated worker visa.
Okay.
The H-1Bs that all these tech companies now rely on because they can pay Indian programmers half of what they pay Americans.
You hear a lot about, I hear this whenever I hear other pundits talk about immigration, which is, the Republicans used to be the pro-immigration party.
Yeah, because so they were pro-business.
In the 90s?
Yeah.
So,
earlier, I guess, maybe.
What was... I mean, some of them talk about even just a few years ago there, which I don't really... Wasn't it... So, I know when Bush had a big immigration push, wasn't it partially elements of the right that...
Right, because it was the social Christians, or the social... Who were pushing for refugees to get into the country, because, you know...
No, but I mean the side that killed it, because I recall amnesty... For people who came here illegally, like the talk you hear now, was something elements of the right, I don't know about the kind of widespread, but was against. Like, they broke the law, they shouldn't be able to stay here. Like, people were like that, and I remember.
Yeah, no, I...
Family members.
Yeah, no, it's nationalism, man. Even left or right, that's easy to...
Okay, yeah.
But you can understand why business is like, no, we need to let these people in. We need workers.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's move on to...
Wait, were we talking about Iran?
Oh, did you ever make it? Yeah, you
did. We do make... I guess...
Somehow...
They trained into immigration, but So, yeah, the agreement's going to get kicked out. Iran said as long as the other parties are willing to abide by it, they're going to abide by it also. Like, even if the U.S. pulls out. But if increased U.S. sanctions, that could get tricky, especially with... So, if Mnuchin... puts broader financial sanctions on Iran, like, kicks them out of the SWIFT transfer network or international financial markets more generally, then that will trigger problems.
Okay.
Yeah, that's about it.
Do you expect that to happen? Or is it just something to keep an eye out for?
It's something to keep an eye out for. See what Mnuchin says when he's in Jerusalem this weekend.
Yeah. He's no longer leading the delegation, by the way.
Right, he's not going to lead the delegation, which...
Does that signal something, or is it just...
It seems like it's a diplomatic protocol, like they finally recognize diplomatic protocol. Like, it's not the ambassador.
Like, on the, like, one of the parties involved that'll be there, that'll have a delegation there, is like, you're not sending someone from the State Department.
Well, they are now, but, like, the person who's leading the delegation is usually the person who's already on the ground to organize all of the events to make sure everybody
like
is where they need to be. Well, I think it's a deputy in this case, yeah. So
he's a deputy. Yeah, deputy. Deputy Secretary of State.
Oh, wow, they still have those?
He's the only one.
He's the only one.
No, we don't know that. We should fact check that, but...
I think there's only one of the appointed nine positions that are...
I just thought that was a little... Mm-hmm. To me, it seemed like someone was insulted by Mnuchin.
Interesting.
Running it. Like, really? Secretary of Treasury? Well, of course we want, like... I would think that someone involved, either from Israel or maybe even Saudi Arabia, whoever else will be there. Maybe even a big, you know, is there going to be an element from United Kingdom or something?
I don't think so. I think the Guatemalans might be there. They're the ones who are also going to move their embassy, but I don't think the Europeans are going to want to have anything to do with this.
Don't even want to show up at
nope.
the ceremony to show?
I mean, send like a deputy ambassador and maybe your equivalent of station chief to keep an eye on things, but...
So, yeah, we should try and look at the crowd there. All right, so big news that happened yesterday, I think. We're recording Tuesday.
New York AG.
Yeah, the sort of anti-Trump darling.
Schneiderman.
Eric Schneiderman.
Yeah.
New York State Attorney General.
And apparently...
Stepped down.
Violence enthusiast? I was hearing NPR's report this morning, and I read a little bit about it, but...
I read the whole... So it was reported by Ronan Farrow, who recently won the Pulitzer for breaking the Harvey Weinstein thing, and Jane Mayer, who's a great investigative journalist, and they got...
She wrote The Dark Side.
Yeah. Four women to talk to them, and two of them, not anonymously, with their names... somewhat prominent, like one of them dated Salman Rushdie before Eric Schneiderman.
It's a weird circle.
Still friends with Salman Rushdie, though. They seem like besties even though they're not dating. So, and anyway, very violent in situations where he was drunk. Multiple accusations of taking some sort of downer. Like, I don't know what it was, can't remember the exact muscle relaxers or something like that.
Okay.
And then he also like was urging one of them to refill their Xanax more.
Oh, okay,
and
there it is.
Like bottle and a half, two bottles of wine a night. And he so drinking problem. But anyways,
substance
he
abuse,
supposedly
yeah.
would be violent to women in situations that he claimed and he sort of claims are sexual. Consenting sexually.
Like I saw some kind of roleplay excuse in a
yes,
headline?
Yes, either in his direct press release or one of them through a spokesman, they said something like it was never not consensual and in the privacy of our bedroom there was role-playing or something like that. And all these women, like, again, not anonymously for two of them, are like, nah, that's bullshit.
Wow.
This was never that. And he'd, like, feed them, like, urge them to drink really aggressively, like, putting it to their lips and trying to get them drunk, too.
That seems abusive.
He's pretty shitty all around. And, glad he's gone. But I've been picking him as my dark horse presidential candidate.
Just like Elliot Spitzer was for me in 2008.
Yeah, and...
Whenever he
probably
was
thinking it, though. That's why Roger Stone went after Spitzer.
What a shame. He would have been a great president.
And Anyway, so Schneiderman is totally out. And by the way, it was not so much like who I wanted to be president. It was like,
that guy's coming up.
I was putting money on it, mm-hmm. type thing. He was just such a public prosecutor. Everything had these big, he was a politician. Mm-hmm. Not saying he wasn't a good prosecutor, but he was a politician first. And I just am like, well, someone who's that effective of a prosecutor, but is a politician first, seems like they have aspirations.
Right, and that's a dangerous combination. Yeah. But what is it about New York politics that kills people's career? Like, Cuomo will obviously never be president. He is at the top of he's the zenith of his political career. And arguably, Clinton, if she had just stayed in Arkansas, probably would have had a more successful Senate career than she had. And that might have actually gotten her into the presidency if she wasn't so seen as in the New York crowd.
Because
she might have had reasons to vote against the bankruptcy bill instead of, you know, reasons to vote for it in 2006, which to me was one of the many things that killed the possibility of me voting for her.
So, it seems like there's two different... are you saying, or maybe it's both, that it's the rest of the country has a kind of negative thing about New York and doesn't like the things that they do that are pro-New York?
Right, and they prove it by being horribly corrupt.
It seems like there's also an element, though, of the New York politics scene itself being very hard-fought with strong interests at play, that they kill each other a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Like how a national champion, you know, out of the Big Ten in football doesn't happen as much because there's so much beating up on each other.
Right. Wisconsin, Ohio State, Michigan, any
Ohio
one of them
State's
would
have... a little bit, but that's been the only one in the past, like, 20 years, really.
Yeah, so. Because they've learned how to, you know, survive the Big Ten every year.
Yeah, just barely. I don't know...
Yeah, I don't know, that's an interesting observation that I had, but yeah, I don't think...
I mean, this one just seems like he was playing politics totally fine. I mean, I'd be surprised if this was some sort of hit piece from his enemies.
No.
Because it has, and it makes a point in the article, so maybe they don't protest too much, but they talk a lot in the article how the initial stuff about Harvey Weinstein, the Me Too, and... Schneiderman's public talking mm-hmm. all this shit, you know, like,
yeah.
How dare Harvey Weinstein treat women this way, you know. And so these women saw this and they're like, what the fuck?
Are you kidding me?
Yeah. And so that kind of like energized them and gave them, more courage, kind of more as a political statement, but they are like these, like, totally his supporters otherwise.
Right.
Like, they love the liberal, strong prosecutor in the AG office. That's their jam. And so it's not like from... doesn't seem like this is like a... would be from someone like a Roger Stone or...
No,
from,
this
from
is
like
just
Republican
some...
Republican or something. Or,
Ronan Farrow and Jane Meyer aren't ambulance chasers.
They don't like to be tools either.
Yeah.
It's an impression I've gathered. Okay.
That guy, that's just a tragic personal failing.
Yeah, that's what. Yeah, that's what. I don't know if it even has to do with New York politics. He's just a fucking terrible person.
Yeah,
and he knew it the whole time. I'm guessing he is going to.
He resigned, didn't he?
Yeah, he resigned like effective pretty much immediately.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. He's moving on.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering if they'll he'll attempt to do some sort of like blame it all on alcoholism. Go to rehab.
Maybe
and then try for, like...
No, he'll just go on Matt Lauer's Me Too rehabilitation show, right?
Matt Lauer has a Me Too rehabilitation show?
I don't know if it was a joke or something, but yeah, there was, like, a... or whichever, not Matt Lauer, but the one who was kicked out because of the Me Too. Was it Charlie Rose? Well, one of them...
Yeah.
...was going to have a talk show where he brought on people who were, you know, the subject of the Me Too movement, basically, and rehabilitate their... public reputations.
Shouldn't it be about rehabilitating the actual people, not their public reputation? Because that is more of a selfish benefit to them.
I mean, maybe they're... Even if they said...
Shouldn't he have victims of sexual abuse on his show?
You'd think, but I think they're just... This is purely nepotistic.
That's pretty shitty.
I mean, I don't PBS, know if that's so. Serious. That might be a joke, but it was pretty widely reported.
Stay tuned.
Because of course they are.
We'll be back with a little talk on information warfare. So I brought up a couple weeks ago, I blame people for meeting on Twitter and trolling people with them. and so you wanted to talk about...
Well, it's a couple... It's kind of a couple different ideas. Like, so let's talk about information warfare. The most convenient for the best... The easiest framework I've come up with for people to think about it are... The seven levels of computer maintenance. I'm not going to go into that in detail, but suffice to say, it goes from, like, the incredibly physical to the incredibly abstract. Like, level one is, does your computer have power? Is it physically connected to a power supply? And then, like, the more abstract levels, like level six and seven, are, like, computer networks. And, like, level seven is, like, just computer, like, thought, like usernames and passwords and content. And that's kind of the level that Twitter operates on. Because if you try to conduct information warfare on some of those lower levels, you are committing very, very actionable felonies.
Yes.
And, you know, even at the upper levels, but Twitter isn't, you know, it's almost a literal representation of the marketplace of ideas.
Okay.
And related to that is the notion that I'm not inclined to trust anyone. So, like, especially not myself, because I know I make mistakes, and individuals are prone to making mistakes. Mm-hmm. And so, to counteract that, humanity naturally tries to disperse its idea generation, ruminations, and decision-making, or needs to,
mm-hmm.
which is why, you know, we want democracy, we want direct participatory democracy, but, you know, we haven't quite gotten there yet.
Let's flesh that one out a bit. So, you're saying the more centralized the information dispersion is, the more likely it is to have mistakes that reverberate throughout the whole operation, because there's fewer individuals. Whereas if you have more people, it's more likely mistakes and information will get buried.
They'll be disregarded because more
people... Yeah, kind of like a simple like Reddit system almost.
Exactly.
But that clearly doesn't always hold true.
Well, Solyndra kind of proved why Reddit's system was flawed.
So what is that?
So, Indra, if you remember, like, I don't know, it must have been 5 or 6 years ago, it was the super admin that got caught, like, selling placement on Reddit. Yeah, he revealed that their entire voting system was just fundamentally flawed and unwieldy. Like, they couldn't really control people gaming it.
Okay.
Which is why I haven't been on Reddit since, except for subreddits.
But, so you're saying it's more the logistics of Reddit that disprove the general idea, then.
Hmm? No, like, Reddit's system disproved why Reddit wouldn't...
Yeah. But it doesn't necessarily extend to just the general idea of a democratization of information.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because the internet still exists. I mean, commercial interests are trying to segregate and impugn our ability to access information through, like...
Yeah.
I mean, academically, through, what's that service that you have to be part of? Like, LexisNexis and JSTOR. Which is a huge firewall for people who don't have access to college libraries. Or...
This is mostly because I was lazy, but I actually found that to be really shitty when I was in school, many moons ago, 15 years ago, because you could only access the science journals if you physically went to the library.
Huh, that's terrible.
You couldn't just sign in with your student name.
Huh, really? I thought they fixed that, because I remember researching...
I'm not saying none are like that or were, but at the time, most of them were not. So if that's gotten better, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it often was you had to... Like, the library bought the thing for library use, not for all students at the university use.
Wow.
Maybe because that may, at the time, would have made it more expensive to buy, I don't know.
Or it's, you know, less control over what gets... how it gets published or shared.
And, you know, you didn't always want, you know... Most of the school year is in winter here in Wisconsin. Who wants to go to the library all the time?
Right? I mean, especially if you're already working on your paper on your computer, why would you want to go to another computer to look up information?
Yeah, so then you gotta, like, fucking disks. Because email wasn't big enough to transfer your files.
Thumb drives, man. I remember when we were in college, it was all thumb drives.
No. Anyway, so democratization of information, good, and...
Well, Twitter, like, also, we also have limited capacity for idea generation. Because, like, no individual person is ever going to have all of the good ideas, or even, like, more than, like, a few good ideas, probably.
Yeah.
So, you need like, we need to be able to see what other good ideas are coming out.
Yes.
Out there. Mm-hmm. As a way of, you know, I guess benefiting our own democracy and our own way of living?
Yeah.
To our better ideal? Yeah. I don't need to really justify that.
No, people generally try and, most people try to most of the time with new ideas.
But so that's, again, why Twitter matters. Well, like, even in on a psychological level, people need to see other people agreeing with them without being prompted to. It's not exactly validation, but it's, you know, room for agreement. You can see how resounding the an individual idea or point of view might be.
Okay.
And the problem with Twitter for this is that it is full of bots and trolls. And it's a Venn diagram of the two, because some of these bots are just weaponized, like...
Mm-hmm.
What did we call it? Weaponized indecency?
Yeah.
That's where it's seen.
They... And they always go for just the worst point, but it's like they all do it. It's always the same.
Mm-hmm.
They always have the same...
line of thought,
yeah. Play the same cards, and you run the same plays, using a sports metaphor.
Because you can automate that.
Yeah. And I was thinking, I like... one thing I pay attention to on, say, Twitter is... like the violence by police against minorities, okay? And
shout out to Sean King.
Yeah, it's a lot of it's through him. And I've noticed there's always some conservative troll who always like. So if you talk about someone getting shot, they'll bring up like more white people get shot than black people, which when you get into the numbers is foolish. But by the time you get that far into the conversation, it's already decayed beyond any sort of.
Reasonable
potential for agreement.
Yeah.
I was just thinking of this today. What a horribly, like, evil way to defend killing one group is saying, yeah, but more of my group gets killed. Like, doesn't that mean there's still a problem?
Right. Doesn't that mean there's still a problem with police violence?
fine. All lives matter. Sure.
Okay.
Then let's act that way.
Right.
Yeah, that's why I kind of get the blue life sort of, like, narrative. Like, I get that more, which is, yeah, but police have all of these blah, blah, blah concerns. Like, to me, that's a better first salvo of an argument than saying, yeah, but my people die.
I know police have a very difficult job. You choose to take that job. There's no draft to be a police officer. So the fact that you're unwilling to engage, like, just be endangered when you know your job is a very dangerous one, maybe you shouldn't have that job.
Yeah. I'm sure we can find people.
Like, I know everybody wants to go home, but I don't think drawing your weapon and shooting someone is necessarily the...
I mean, it's not even, isn't it, like, there's some research out on the subject, and it's not, like, the most dangerous job in the country, in terms of injuries and deaths.
Yeah, it's forestry, right?
I don't know what number one is. I don't think it's number two. I guess it is up there, but I'm pretty sure it's not, like, there's other things, but probably fucking, like, fishermen and shit.
I mean, it's, well, the problem with the job is that you are, you know, you're thrown into certain loops, which encourage certain feedback and behaviors, which, yeah. you know, makes very good people become more paranoid and perhaps more aggressive that against certain crimes.
Yeah.
But, I don't know, did you see the, I posted a video this week, Sean King also did, or I think he may have posted it first, or maybe not, but this guy, like, trips a fleeing suspect. Did you listen to the banter afterwards of what the cops were saying? No. Yeah, they were like, I was almost about to shoot that guy. Yeah, me too. They were, like, moments away from, like, shooting a running suspect.
But it's, that banter, now that you have more body cam... By the way, body camera stuff with mm-hmm. the police is... has. It maybe hasn't fixed everything by any means, even in the places where they have it, mm-hmm. but it's allowing that conversation to progress.
Right, to bring it back to the information warfare thing.
To get back into, like, policemen. Because one of the big questions about the police violence, right, is motive. And so much of it is they try and take away, like, the details and the thoughts and the words and just be like, in that split second, you thought he may have a gun, and so, yeah. But if you can... get more and more on the record of them not really showing any fear for their lives and having fucking banter like that, or like the, you know, even though he was exonerated, like the one, the cop who had like fuck him or something written on. Remember the guy who, it was actually a white guy, he just like fucking executed in like a hotel
hallway? Oh, right, in Arizona.
He was trying to like, yeah.
They were, he was crawling away, yeah.
But stuff like that, those little things that all start adding up
to like motivation,
I think it'll matter a lot, and I think it's nothing but proved that it's a good idea.
Right, we need more transparency.
Any downside of it?
I mean, I guess
some places are still fighting it, but
well, of course, police fraternities are going to continue to fight that because they're going to lose those, start losing those arguments that have protected them for time immemorial.
Self-interest, yeah,
and you know, maybe there's. Probably, I hope they're going through these records, too, because there's probably some pretty severe privacy things or violations that could occur if, you know, police go into people's homes in very sensitive situations.
Yeah.
And, you know, not everybody's name needs to be released, but the purposes of the video isn't to catch what other people are doing, it's to see what the police are doing.
Yeah.
So even if they cut out all of the other people in that video and left it purely about the police and just their hands, I would be perfectly okay with that.
Yeah. By the way, if it was ever used, though, not so much talking about, like, the privacy, but if there was something that was in police footage that proved someone did something that was a crime...
Right, as evidence.
That's
fine.
I'm fine with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It shouldn't, like, not be allowed or anything like that.
Yeah, obviously, I don't...
In general, there might be instances. And, right. And so, yeah, so anyway, that's a good example of information warfare.
Exactly.
So
again, we need this conversation on platforms like Twitter. Like, if you think you have a good idea, please share it with everyone. Because, like... I'm going, especially as this election year comes up, we're going to need everybody on board for all of their ideas and every way to reach people mm-hmm. that we can come up with, like, because maybe people aren't being motivated by traditional platforms and, like, issue planks as they were 20 years ago, and we need to reconsider how to reach these darn kids and whatnot.
Yeah.
But on a second note, we need to inure ourselves from this vitriol and... the spam and the bots and everything that makes us frustrated about the whole process.
Because you see this from even people who love Twitter, there's like a common refrain of it's so negative and so toxic. And it does feel like you're a little bit like walking through like a dangerous neighborhood or something. Like, Twitter, like, it just has this sick feeling to it a little bit. I pick up. If you start reading through comments.
Oh, that's
where,
yeah. If you go, like, turn off the main roads.
Yeah, and that's speaking to your first point about, just in general, disseminating ideas and having that conversation. A lot of that is, like, who you follow and, like, mm-hmm. articles you read. But, I mean, it has a strong comment, you know, and that's is a way for people to get thoughts and ideas out.
Right.
But it's so.
It's really toxic once you get below the comments.
So how do you endure yourself?
I mean, I typically don't read comments. I've been trying to participate more just because, you know, I'm in favor of this. Like, Yeah. And as a disclaimer, I really, really hate Twitter.
Oh.
I don't like it. I hate the fact that I have to be on it to participate in these discussions, but...
Okay, so why not the alternative? So you brought up Reddit, actually.
Because
why not other social media?
It's too moderated. And because of that, the moderation invites corruption. It invites, you know, a collapse of opinions into one singular right idea, or correct idea, which is contradictory to reason and debate, or rhetorical exchange and debate.
Mm-hmm.
We don't develop that way.
Yeah.
This is energy cooling, not energy being exploded out into the universe.
Okay, yeah. That's a good way of putting it. And so you brought up, like, to get into details, like, Facebook, because it operates on, like
purely friendship.
Friend family.
Mm-hmm. Like, smaller circles and networks, so you're not going to reach, like, I see things from activists in other parts of the country now because of Twitter and see what they're doing, and, if anybody's listening to this podcast, this is mostly about how are you people, what is effective activism in this day and age? We need good ideas.
What is it?
I mean, Code Pink is in Washington, so they can do things, but what are we supposed to do out in, like, the flyover states, as it were? There are some terrible policies that are drastically affecting lives, and how do we, like, register opposition? Like, calling congressmen, to me, I mean, I love Tammy Baldwin and Mark Pocan, but calling or writing them is absolutely useless.
I think it can be effective on, like, a zoom-out way, where there's certain issues that may get some sort of overwhelming, huge amount of calls and stuff, and it might kind of, like, help forge the ideas.
But then you're
editing one way or another, but it doesn't really change positions.
Like,
I shouldn't say forge, I should have said more like solidified.
Right.
It took something that was already there and just strengthened it one way or another. And I think there's probably a bias on the parts of the staff and how they respond, what they respond to, if at all.
If at all.
I don't know. I mean, I think it also is so easy for people to do, though, that for certain issues, I think it helps a little bit.
I mean, I'm sure they're getting buried in responses now, especially with the automation.
Yeah.
We're fighting with crayons against, like, AIs.
It seems like there needs to be more congressmen.
You think?
And well, it's maybe senators. And on the federal level. I mean,
more?
What has it? Oh, I wish I knew more history for this. But has it always been the same number of people per?
Like, the original formulation in the Constitution suggested that we would have far more representation than we do now.
On the federal,
Yeah, like the House of Representatives should be huge.
Yeah,
because it's based off of raw population.
It's been the same number of seats for a long time, right? I don't know about the beginning, but at least.
Yeah, it hasn't grown, like, as with the curve of the population.
Yeah, at a more direct
correlation,
And it just seems like, there should be way more, like, I can go talk to, as an average person, I can get in to talk to someone. And that person will, like your alderman. Like, if you go to your alderman and actually make a stink about something, you could have no power and resources, and in a lot of cities in this country, you can get a decent response.
Yeah, you could maybe even meet them.
Yeah.
Like, especially if you show up at meetings and you try to speak to them off to the side.
A little bit of an effort, you can have a pretty outsized role if you really want.
Yeah.
And it seems like we should have that a little bit more on the federal level.
Yeah.
But instead, we have to resort to Twitter.
All right. And, you know, we're stuck within the bounds of our institution, so it's voting. So, make sure everybody votes. Everybody make sure you vote in your elections. Local to federal.
But in the information war thing, though, like... what should be your weapons? I mean, is...
Just your good ideas and your ability to just be stubborn about them.
Okay, so you should be a little stubborn.
I mean, if you think you're right and your reasoned opinion is, you know, is based on facts, and I mean, maybe you should.
You know, I've kind of found, I not really disagree with this, but I had a thought the other day that this whole, and I'm not saying we shouldn't be, in general, an enlightened society in the classical definition, but, you know, logic, facts, reason
right.
are great tools. But it doesn't really win you anything.
No.
It's more about what you care about and why you care about it.
Right.
And you can't make someone care about a thing through just reason. You can make them maybe agree with you, which doesn't happen much, but maybe you can be mm-hmm. like, okay, yeah, fine. But no one's gonna, like, give a strong shit about climate change if it doesn't
impact
if they it. Think it doesn't affect them mm-hmm. or they're not vested in it. You might be able to get them to, like, just say yes or no, but they're not going to necessarily become an advocate or proponent.
No, certainly not.
So, like, I mean, so I guess, like, how do you make people, like,
how do you make people care? But,
cause, you know, you're saying, like, spread good ideas, people might agree, and also.
But again, this is part of the reason I'm looking for, we're doing this, we need to know what motivates people. I've been thinking about this a lot, and mm-hmm. I can't come up with anything more than what we've already been using. And it's frustrating. I mean, we've got call log, you can call people, you can knock on their door, which seems effective. But
mm-hmm.
it seems inappropriate to go door to door for just niche issues in off political years.
How do you replicate going door to door using social media? You
can't. Like, people can ignore their phones. It becomes a lot more difficult to ignore a person in your face because you have to acknowledge. Like, because back in the back of our monkey brains, it's like, oh, that is also another person. Like, looking at your phone, you don't have that same instinct, like, this is not a person, which makes it easier to argue in vitriolic ways on Twitter.
Yeah, there's definitely separation between, like, you and your avatar.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I don't have a good summary to this, but please, people, keep arguing on Twitter. It's, I mean, we don't grow without challenge, too.
Yeah.
If you want to just...
No, I like this because I think it's, I've kind of grown out of the notion that it's all bad and it's all the things people say are bad about it are actually even all bad.
Right.
Like the arguing on Twitter. There's, you know, hey, maybe it's not like that fucking end of society.
Hash it out, people.
Maybe it's the beginning of the new society. You just have to, if you know your history, like it's, people say, like, oh, are we in the most divided partisan time in American history? And they're like, dude, the very beginning was bitterly divided. And maybe that's just a result of a new thing being born. That's how it...
Right.
You know? A little bit of conflict.
Right. Society divides, and we hash out the conflicts, violently and otherwise, and move on.
But I would say this is better than violently.
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, Argue on Twitter.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right.
The white supremacists, if they're arguing on Twitter, won't be encouraged to go out and shoot people.
Let's keep them occupied.
But again, I don't know. This is part of the information warfare thing. Like, just as we're organizing, like progressives and liberals, like the right has also been organizing like this for perhaps the better part of a decade. If anything, we're a little behind the other side.
They're like a prequel Star Wars. The fucking, like, the Emperor, that side, had fucking a clone army, they called it. And that's the version here of the trolls and bots.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no, we've been working on this. You have to play catch up to us.
Yeah.
We secretly plotted this shit. And not trying to be too conspiratorial, but, in terms of a small group. I mean, it's been a big thing.
It's just the Kochs and the Mercers and Bannon.
No, I think it goes down to, like, there was a article, legal expert Dave sent out, about, it's like, I can't remember the group, but they're a group that investigates how Koch money is spent at their universities.
Hmm.
And the one was at...
was it Unkoch My University?
I think that might be it. Okay. And I think it was George Mason? I mean, I could be wrong about
George
that.
Mason University,
okay, it was George Mason. How they had like $30 million spent by the Kochs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but they've been doing that shit for 30 years. It's kind of training, like, mutating the ivory tower in a way.
Right, bending it to their will.
Yeah, it wasn't naturally going to be... Like, I think in that article, the person, the you know, it's on a blog, it's not like New York Times, the person says at the beginning, does anyone actually think libertarianism would spread on its own merits? And yeah, I mean, I think this, this kind of preparation for war has been going on for, I think, since the 80s.
Right, and some of these kids are obviously adopting a much more militant aspect of it, which has turned into Atomwaffen-Division and Identity Europa and the 3% movement. And
yeah, there's
all
like
of these
splinter groups because anyone's going to take it to an illogical extreme.
Right.
And in their case, their kind of baseline ideology, I think, has such a potential for sick extremes. Or maybe at its most tame, it isn't that bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really like tame kind of little bit of libertarianism, but
sure.
I think it, the way they've marketed it, the people they've marketed it to, this toxic libertarianism, to like rural white men,
who are
individualists or isolated from the rest of society and from cities and culture.
And just national socialists.
Well, yeah. Hey, you want to be allowed to do your thing?
Yeah, I mean, wasn't I going to talk about the Democrats at some point about this, too?
How the Democrats can...
Oh, right, the interference in primaries was the other point that we were going to talk about this, behind this.
About the DCC?
Yeah, the DCC, the DCCC.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of ossifying their, again, the ideation and decision-making, because, you know, you heard that Steny Hoyer, the recording that The Intercept released from Colorado 6, that seems to, like, directly contradict the notion of democracy. Like, a decision was made, and you should move out because we picked this person. Not because they're necessarily better, not because the voters like them, not because they necessarily have better ideas, but because they're party insiders, and that's...
Well, isn't the idea, at least the explicit, that it's someone they think will win.
Right, because these are
the
same...
they're maybe making bad choices about... Like
right,
first, there's two arguments. Is what they did wrong, and is the reason they did it wrong. Or at least what they say. Is that where exactly is the lie?
I would say both of them are wrong. Though what they're doing is wrong, because the Democratic Party should notionally be neutral in primaries. And why they're doing it is also wrong, because they're going to the same, like, few consultant groups who are telling them who to pick, and these people haven't picked a winner in, like, at least a decade. Like, okay, after a few elections where they lose, can we stop paying them and stop listening to them?
That's sort of the empirical argument.
Yeah.
The results-based argument. Okay, whether or not you have been doing the right thing, it hasn't been working.
So maybe you're not doing the right thing.
That's a fair point. I think there is a really good argument, though, of trying to have a heavy hand in picking winners. See, I guess I don't completely agree that they should be neutral.
Oh, okay.
I think on some level that's how we...
But,
and maybe you think it's a fair price to pay, which is a totally fine argument, but that's widely considered to be one of the reasons we have Donald Trump. Is there was not a heavy hand at the upper ends of the Republican Party that was used, at least. Maybe they could have, but...
I mean, they kind of did. Look at all of his he got how many of the arch-conservative donation people behind him?
A lot of them weren't right away. I mean, the Mercers weren't right away.
Weren't they? I thought...
No, they were Ted Cruz.
Oh, okay.
And I think it's, can't remember which one was behind Carson.
Was that Wilde?
I think even Sheldon Adelson wasn't for Trump until later on. Even if they weren't supporting him right away, what I'm arguing is if you had a strong party, they would have just shut him down immediately.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of their job. But that doesn't mean that, I guess what I'm saying is having a heavy hand is okay, but it should be used more wisely.
So I mean, I don't
weigh this what they're doing. I think we both don't agree with. I think I just have a slightly different reason.
Yeah. I don't know. If they wanted to participate, they could participate as individuals, but having, like, these huge overarching organizations that are supposed to be neutral pitch in kind of, like, defeats the cause, because it's going to defeat enthusiasm in the general election, obviously. This is the same pattern as 2016 all over again. Just repeated, like, en masse and to a greater extent or another. Or a greater or lesser extent across all the congressional congressional districts okay. and representatives.
So, let's look at an example where we don't really have skin in the game of something similar and see if you fall down on the same side.
Okay.
The Republicans in West Virginia...
Blankenship.
...are... So, I mean, dude... Blankenship, what's Don? Is it Don
yeah.
Blankenship? Mm-hmm. He was in prison for a year for not blowing up.
No, he absolutely...
no, I know, but like in his telling, I didn't even blow up those people.
I wasn't there physically. I didn't actually kill them.
I didn't press a button and blow up. Yeah. Anyway, he's being singled out by kind of some of the upper ends of the Republican Party. He sort of personifies it as just Mitch McConnell, but I... Imagining it's not just single-handedly Mitch. Do you think if you were Mitch McConnell or just the bigwigs in the Republican Party, would you think it would be good to make sure that guy doesn't get your nomination?
But again, they could do that on an individual basis, have any number of campaign rallies. Hell, Mitch McConnell himself can go door-to-door in West Virginia. But if the Republican Party says, we don't want this guy in our primary, that's...
Really?
Kind of a problem. See, like, even the guy...
That's a problem.
Well, I mean, it's the marketplace of ideas, right? If he has currency in that marketplace, then we should listen to him. I mean, and this is why I have problems with the stilted marketplace, which gives us Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Mm. Like, and I can understand, like, if the party as a whole wants to reject a certain kind of person or platform that gets out, you know, your Paul Nalins and that California Senate candidate who they just kicked, they didn't even let in their convention. Really? He, like, tried to register and they're like, you need to leave, sir.
Okay.
Like, let's hash it out. We don't grow except through challenge, so bring it. let's have these debates and arguments. I mean, if Don Blankenship can really appeal to West Virginia after killing 29 minors because he didn't care about their safety, then I don't know what that says about West Virginia.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's been a little deep dive into information warfare, how it will affect the primaries, and we'll be back with a grown-up book report. We'll grab that book first.
Yeah, that kind of got off track.
Back with a grown-up book report. I have another biographical comic book to talk about. This one is about Johnny Cash. It's called Johnny Cash, I See a Darkness, a graphic novel by Reinhard Kleist. Now, this is a black and white comic. I can show it to you, Charles, because you're actually here.
Oh, wow.
It's very good art. Pretty, kind of
kind of minimalist,
and it's thick lines, a lot of black. You know, it's called "I See a Darkness."
Right.
it takes place from his childhood up through. It actually ends with him doing his what were those called? American recordings or something with Rick Rubin. I'm going to forget the exact title of the albums, but they're essentially the last albums he released.
Mm-hmm.
And each chapter kind of starts with sort of a graphical retelling of a song, and sort of puts sometimes him, what looks like to be him, in the role, even though they're not real stories. So it starts with forget which song exactly it is, but you know the one that goes, "I shot a man in Reno
just to watch him die."
He's in Reno, he shoots a man just to watch him die. You know, it's not him per se. And then there's a couple, they do the Ballad of Ira Hayes and a couple other songs. And then otherwise it's pretty much biographical. It really focuses on Benny's. He's popping Benny's for years. Got in trouble trying to cross the border from Mexico with them once. Excuse me. And yeah, apparently, I mean, and then drinking, you know, apparently he had a bit of a
problem.
So it kind of has like a personal, like a lot of like biopics in general, like movies, you know, like the Ray Charles movie focuses on like heroin use. You know, they kind of have like this dark side, the human drama, which
highlight the flaws.
Yeah, I mean, and he was very explicit kind of about that in many ways. The thing that I found most interesting about the book, and I don't know if I'll be able to find the page right away here, is, I thought I had it. So it talks about essentially kind of a divide in his fan base. And if you think about it, it's not really surprising, but I never knew this, which is why I'm pointing it out. Which is a lot of the kind of conservative elements of kind of average fans, but also kind of like the industry around country music and that type of thing,
yeah.
Was racist. Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise.
The 60s and 70s, you know? And then also the Vietnam War was going on for a while during, and so he had these kind of stances on things which made him a little unpopular. So I'm just going to read these, because I think they're pretty interesting.
Right, because there's a socialist folk element, or a socialist folk.
Yeah, but he also was sort of patriotic. Mm-hmm. So if you think of one of the lines of one of his songs is, I think it's from Man in Black. It's like, you know, he's kind of listing these groups of people that he does it for.
Mm-hmm.
But he has one about the men fighting overseas who've died 1,000 times before, or something like that. And this, I think this quote will kind of get into that. I've never quite, and I think this is just from the writer's perspective, I don't think this is supposed to be a character if I recall. I've never quite understood Johnny's mixed attitude to all the wars that this country was and is mixed up in. But I try to explain it to myself like this. That it's always the poor and those that got the least that risk their necks for the big shots up top. And it's for these people that Johnny's heart beats, not for what's dragged them into war.
Hmm.
And that's why he sings in front of that torn up old flag about the folks that give their lives believing God is on their side. Which I think is in Man in Black, that line. God is on their side.
So a proto-support the troops idea.
Yeah, but really troop-based more than support the war.
Right.
But I'm assuming there was kind of a slight bit of an unwillingness to be explicitly anti-war in his rhetoric.
I don't know.
Really remember him.
I don't know.
I mean, we weren't around the time, and this book doesn't really get into it, but I just have a hard time picturing Johnny Cash was at, like, anti-war rallies.
Well, it seems like being for the troops in that way back then meant that you were against war, almost explicitly.
I think didn't see it that way, though.
You don't think?
I think there were conservative elements that saw it the exact opposite way.
Well, I mean, that's what we have in our post-11 experience, but I think 20 years before then, like, being in favor of the troops, because if you remember, those troops got spat on when they got back.
Yeah. But
I guess that was from, like, the left kind of reactionary, so...
It's
like one of the middle... It's, yeah, a niche middle ground kind of for that
time period. And I think it just was he was in a spot. The Ballad of Ira Hayes goes into a Native American who fights in World War II, I believe.
Yeah.
And is kind of treated like
one of the most decorated people in World War II, yeah.
And how he's just, like, left to die.
He dies, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Reservation or something. Yeah. So, and that's one of the ones he does in here, and it's one of the more vivid artists, like, almost surreal in the art, which is really cool. Find that. And then there's one other bit that this really stuck out to me. So, Johnny Cash was married to, I think she was an Italian woman before June Carter Cash. Before June Carter. And he had a couple kids with her. Not a great husband and father, but not necessarily what this is about.
Not part of
the point. And he was given a super light sentence, I believe, for him bringing those pills across the border. And so it's kind of viewed as a win, because it was like time served. It was like 48 hours time served or something like that. Wow. He got off really light. And there was a picture after he was, you know, at the courthouse, and his wife was there, and he kind of like views it like, even though she didn't really like him that much at the time, but like her presence kind of made him seem more like a real like a good person, so that, you know, don't give him a harsh sentence. And so this is a pictorial element to the picture, which I can show you. It has a Johnny Cash looking sort of down, and then a woman with what looks like an afro, right?
Yeah.
But she was Italian, as I said, or Spanish or Italian or something. She was not black. But in this, which you could picture like a not terribly in focus black and white picture, kind of like this drawn depiction, she sort of looks black in the picture. So here's what it says. Those photo, after he was let go, those photos went round the world. I've seen them too, and I tell ya, I was mighty shocked. Stevie, I'm not sure what this is, the perspective this is from, but it's not really important. But worse than that was what the Klan did. They tried to make out that Vivian, his wife, was actually colored. They wanted to discredit Johnny with the conservatives because of his commitment to the Indians. He even got death threats because of it. Imagine that. But we are, after all, in the land of unlimited possibilities. The history of the Indians and Ira Hayes shows us that especially well. And in it, it's his sad fate Johnny sings about on the single, that was Ira Hayes. So it kind of gets into like his views on Indians making him unpopular with the conservatives. But I'd never heard anything like that. I didn't know that.
Well, I mean, the Italian, like the Klan was mostly an anti-immigrant thing, right? Well, I mean, parts in the 1920s it was. It kind of turned
Italians were one of the targets. It was sort of a lie it was built around.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Trying to discredit him.
And they hated Italian people enough to be.
Yeah, so once they found out, they probably already.
Like, oh, well, we already hated her.
But, yeah, it just, it seems like some shit you'd hear today, like trying to.
It's a smear job.
Like, think about, John McCain, in 2000 with Karl Rove. Having those robocalls about having a black baby.
No, they like passed her picture around in South Carolina. It's like, oh, here's John McCain's daughter.
But even though it wasn't.
Well, it was his adopted daughter. She's like from South Asia.
Oh. No. They had some robocalls that he like had like an illegitimate black child. That's what they did in South Carolina.
I thought the thing was that Karl Rove like sent pictures of his daughter around to all those super racist towns down there, and they were like, oh, well, if that's his daughter, yeah, like, we can't support her, or support him.
Could just be both, too.
Could be both, yeah. I guess it's not mutually exclusive. I mean, information warfare.
But anyway, that type of similar mentality is not, like, I don't know, hopefully we see less of that.
Hopefully.
Our previous discussion. So anyway, that was the book I highly recommended if you're into fucking Johnny Cash or,
Well, did he get into, like, country music? Because, like, Johnny Cash kind of, like, created, not exactly pop country, but, you know, popular country music.
They get a little bit into his weird place in it all. So, when he first recorded and became had some prominence, he was a little bit more in the rock and roll. You know, he's recording at, I believe it's Sun Studios, Sun Records or whatever it is, where like Elvis and Roy Orbison and all them are from. He was a little bit more in a country circuit, I think, when he toured, cause he was always sort of straddling that line. They talk about in the comic, they show him having like this kind of, falling out with, the Grand Ole Opry.
Oh.
Cause he was like, you know, he's the man in black. He was cool. He had a fuck the world attitude.
Controversial.
And that, they were like, you know, Gene Autry, pretty old country songs. You know, Grand Ole Opry represented, I think they also had a rough relationship with Elvis.
Of course.
And they also get into the book about him taking on or wanting to do more gospel, because that's like the stuff he knew. Mm-hmm. There's like a little moment in the book when he's at a low point, and I don't know if this is entirely accurate, but it's in the comic, where he like kind of like drunkenly goes into this cave and sort of goes on like a trip almost. He goes into this deep cave, his flashlight runs out, he's just kind of suicidal, someone's like, you'll never come out alive, and he still goes in and he like sees his like dead brother, and he has this like kind of come to God moment where he's like, you gotta speak the word, you know, sing the word of God, give this gift more, and you know, spread the gospel, sing gospel songs, and so he kind of comes out and feels more revived, and they sort of point to that helping him a little bit with addiction, though I don't know if he ever fully kicked it. I'm not sure.
I don't think.
Maybe when he's really old, you know. I don't know. And so anyway, it does kind of get into that, like, is he country? Is he gospel? Is he rock and roll? Like, you know, and then either way, he's at least a little more progressive with some of his value, you know.
Sure.
It's a weird, you know, and then he has these like personal issues, which just creates more kind of chaos and conflict. But he sort of came out of it like a legend. I mean, who doesn't like Johnny Cash? Do people hate Johnny Cash? Is there anyone?
It seems un-American to dislike Johnny Cash.
Yeah, I could see people being not that into it, but I don't know. There must be people out there who hate him, but
I assume.
I've never met someone. Never met someone who's like, you know what? I hate Johnny Cash songs.
Maybe if you're so straight edge that you don't listen to music by people who ever do drugs, you could probably hate him for maybe not barbiturate abuse cool, but you know.
Yeah. I don't know, there's always like a sort of guiltiness, self-aware guiltiness to like the characters. Well, even like his characters are doing something bad, they sort of have that Christian, like, I'm a sinner.
Like, mm-hmm. I know what I'm doing is wrong, but...
Yeah, and sometimes, they usually pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
They get caught by the police, you know, like in Cocaine Blues. There's another one, I can't remember what the song is, but it's about just some kid who, like, borrows his brother's gun, and he just is going to go shoot, and he sees, like, a rider in the distance, and just, like, he's never used a gun before, something like that, and shoots the person dead, and then, like, in the end, the person gets hung for it.
Yeah. The song is about how he runs away from that.
Yeah, he sort of tries to run away from it, but he gets caught, and there's always sort of like a reckoning.
Yeah.
Maybe
Johnny Cash knew that he was going to be headed for a reckoning by the end of it.
Yeah, I think, but there's never... So, I mean, it's hard to say it's... Even though it kind of has this spirit of, like, rebellion, it's... I don't know, in a way you can see you could, like, view it either way, I guess is what I'm saying. You can view it as either, like... I mean, law and order or anti-law and order.
He's law and order. He kind of he's kind of anti-order, but in a karmic sense, he knows that karma is a whole other thing than law and order.
And he has that song at one of the last songs he does, like, God's gonna cut you down or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Hurts.
Yeah. Alright, well, yeah, we'll talk about
that's great. Dash.
We'll be back with some closing thoughts. Alright, we're back with some closing thoughts. What do you want to start with? You want to start with Rudy?
Sure. I mean, let's talk about the... I mean, is he the worst lawyer ever, or some mad legal genius?
Right, he can't be a mad legal genius. That can't be the answer.
Maybe not legal genius, precisely, but kind of a... It might be a PR coup. If he puts, like, I'm not entirely sure that these are the worst things that he's defending Trump against, but
yeah.
If he just puts all the cards on the table so everybody knows what they are, then he kind of, like, puts, a nice squelch of cold water on any surprises that could get too out of hand.
Yeah,
On the other hand, it's just a terrible idea that he, you know, basically admitted that Trump... It looks increasingly shady.
What he admitted that might be a breaking of the law, mm-hmm. although it seems to be less harder to prosecute breaking of the law than what was he refuted
right.
by saying what he said about it's mostly campaign finance.
Right. It's not like because campaign finance
the money and mm-hmm. who.
Yeah, because campaign finance laws are very, very easy to, like, those violations are very easy to prove and charge. But money laundering and structured payments, it gets a lot murkier.
Yeah, I mean, there's still a reading of what happened that it... I think it comes down to whether or not they did it to help them win the election or not. Which is harder to prove, and it comes down to an intent thing again.
Well, I mean, the time frame kind of improves that, I would guess, I would say. Didn't he pay off?
Yeah, I mean, I agree.
He paid her off in the middle of the election. It wasn't because... Yeah.
Well, and that might have been the worst thing Giuliani said, is that he said, I think, on Hannity, or maybe it was Fox and Friends, this was because, you know, like, could you imagine if this were to come out right before the election?
Like, oh my god, you're the worst lawyer ever.
Then that means even if Trump paid him back, regardless of, like, where the money came from...
It was a campaign.
Still spent in order to help the election, which means...
It's a campaign contribution, yeah. It's money spent on his own campaign, which means he needs to register with the Federal Election Commission.
Yeah.
Which he probably did not. Oh, and it... And his ethics forms.
Yes. What ethics forms?
Yeah, anyway. Poor Walter Schaub.
So...
Is he a genius or a maniac? I guess we'll have to see.
Yeah, I would say... I mean, I don't know. He might... I think the best reading of it is he is someone who can be aggressive on the media to push the Overton window in a similar matter to the way Trump does it, too. Because if you're looking at, okay, what's bad about what Giuliani just did? It's because he said stupid things and admitted to crimes and didn't really make sense.
Yeah.
But that's all shit that Trump does himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, maybe it is kind of a... because it's so easy to see what's... Like, when you are against Trump, it's so easy to see... And even if you're not, like, really... You know, you just, like, someone pays attention to the news and thinks he's an idiot.
Yeah.
It's so easy to see him as an idiot and not like him, but he's been the exact same way for years now, and so the people that voted for him that like him, they...
Know what you
expect.
That
way of defending... themselves.
Yeah.
They like the way Trump talks about these issues and they like the way Giuliani does, presumably.
Right.
And don't give a shit.
Assumedly.
So maybe it just gives him, like, it's not to win people over, but to keep him where he is.
Huh.
Just a way to
keep his name out there? I don't know.
That's a weird goal for Trump.
Yeah.
There's not enough talk about me in the world. That probably is true, though.
Yeah.
He probably does think that, like, oh my god, they went 5 minutes on MSNBC without talking about me.
There's not enough positive coverage of what I'm doing.
Colin Giuliani.
So, worst lawyer, best lawyer, I guess we'll have to wait for history to really judge. But in the near term...
there's White House counsel, which is McGahn, although mm-hmm. he's stepping down, isn't he, too?
Yeah.
I didn't get into that. Jesus Christ. So, McGahn is White House counsel. So, he represents the... Office of the Presidency
right,
in their dealings with the rest of government.
Yeah.
And then there's, I don't know exactly who runs it, it's probably that Sekulow, Jay Sekulow, who's like, fucking weird, but he...
Another shady New York lawyer.
Well, but he has all these roots in, like, all of these, like, super, like, pro-life and right-wing...
What?
Yeah, no, his background comes from, like, culture battles.
Oh, he's a culture warrior?
The legal, which is... In one hand, totally, oh, that makes sense
yeah, that
for
makes
Trump
sense.
To do.
Obvious.
But
yeah.
On the other hand, it's like, but why? Why are you... Anyway. And so then... But then there's also... Ty Cobb. No, they hired... It's not Giuliani replacing Ty Cobb. It's that other... It's that new guy who is part of the Clinton and George W. Bush council.
So
no,
what?
He's playing... Replaced. Oh my God, I'm getting too confused. Straightened out. Emmett Flood. That's what I'm thinking of.
Hmm.
Republican defense attorney. He also worked with Bill Clinton. If he was a Republican back then. And he's replacing Ty Cobb.
So
which is the White House's response to the special counsel.
Okay.
And then Sekulow is Donald Trump's personal response to the Russian thing.
Okay, it's getting
so
tough
to... So there's two separate offices, and then there's also Don McGahn's White House counsel office, which I don't know if they've announced some replacement for that one yet. And so now I can't remember how Giuliani... He's maybe coming in on the...
He's not becoming White House counsel.
Personal side.
Yeah, no way.
Well, no, not...
He's not becoming in under any official capacity, right?
Well, I mean...
Well, I mean, at any official...
What exactly is Rudy Giuliani's role? Brought into Trump's legal team.
Yeah, okay.
So he's working with, like, the Sekulow crowd. He's probably replacing that Dowd, who stepped on a few weeks ago.
Yeah, that makes sense. What a cast of characters.
So... Yeah, so there's a lot of competing interests. And that's not even counting the legal representation for other clients involved in this.
Huh.
You know, some of these lawyers are representing like a couple clients,
mm-hmm.
which I've seen pointed out as like, isn't that totally inappropriate?
Not. If you can compartmentalize.
If they ever would have competing interests,
yeah.
It would be.
Yeah.
At least.
I would think.
Yeah, I mean, if you have one client willing to turn on another one, and they're both... Like, I mean, that's maybe...
Well, it might be good for the, like, from a legal the legal advice perspective, you would advise that person to throw that other person under the bus. Even
yeah,
if
but
it's
then if you're the... But if you're also
the lawyer for
the
guy who's getting thrown under the bus, then...
That's not...
But you would have...
Depends who's paying for that hour?
Well, your legal obligation is to give the best advice, right? So you would have to tell that guy to throw your client under the bus,
that's
and then...
You shouldn't represent multiple people.
Well...
If that could ever happen.
Yeah, but... Also, as your lawyer, you should also, well, as that other guy's lawyer, you would be negotiating with the prosecutor to make sure you don't get thrown under the buses, all of the buses' wheels. Like, you maybe get thrown under one of the front wheels at, like, a clip.
Yeah.
But being a lawyer is a complicated profession.
Yeah. So, let's move from D.C. and New York and Fox and Friends to our own version of some... Republican corruption in Wisconsin.
Robin Voss.
Robin Voss from Raytown, Racine.
Is he?
Yeah, he represents. I don't know if it's like the city of Racine. You remember that Rolling Stone report talking about gerrymandering?
Mm-hmm.
That kind of got into some of the gerrymandering around his seat, I believe.
Isn't that Pleasant Prairie or whatever it is?
Pleasant Prairie's in Kenosha. It might include be part of a district.
Oh, okay. Or Burlington. Is Burlington in Racine
Burlington
County?
Burlington is in Racine County.
Okay.
Burlington and Union Grove would be the western kind of population centers in the western, more rural area.
Mm-hmm.
Racine's like the big city on the lake in
yeah.
the eastern part of the county. Anyway, which would be different watersheds, we've learned from all Foxconn reporting.
Thanks, Foxconn.
Shout
anyway, out to Scott Gordon.
Yeah. So Robin Voss is kind of being caught up, although the response in Wisconsin seems different than Ohio. He's being caught up in what's what I believe took down the speaker of their representatives in Ohio.
How am I just hearing about this?
Oh, he's the speaker in Ohio was caught up, I think it's the FBI. I'm pretty sure it's the FBI.
Oh, wow.
Because he went on these trips paid for by lobbyists.
Hmm.
And the thing is, Robin Voss went on the same trips.
Oh, right, because he's an ALEC guy.
He's not being investigated, at least no one knows. If he's being investigated by the FBI, he claims he has not been contacted.
Well, because it's a separate U.S. attorney.
Sure. Also, I believe there's just different state law about filing the correct paperwork.
Well, but if the FBI is involved, that's not state.
Yeah, but, I mean, he's... claimed to have filed all the right paperwork. That Robin Voss, this is
yeah.
how he differentiates it from what happened
to in Ohio.
Who, by the way, that guy in Ohio, it was the best man at Robin Voss's wedding.
Oh, man. Dude, this isn't a good picture. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but this doesn't look good.
So it was Cliff Rosenberger who stepped down. Man, I hope I'm getting this right. Pretty sure I am. Cliff, in Ohio, less than a month ago. Now they have an interim speaker until, whenever they figure that out, I guess.
Probably this fall.
And I believe he didn't just step down from the speakership, but from the office. I would speculate, by the way, jumping ahead a bit, that this is a reason Robin Voss is not running for the Wisconsin First District.
Oh, I bet, right? At least. Among the reasons.
There's at least something there that, even if it's not going to get him in legal trouble, could get him in political trouble. Mm-hmm. Probably already is.
Yeah.
I mean, but it probably doesn't matter in keeping his current seat. He probably thinks, as the incumbent, he can do that easily.
Yeah.
But he doesn't want to take that up against, you know, whoever the Democratic nominee will be.
No, no experienced politician is going to touch the race on either side.
Well, I don't know if there's any in the first district that don't have baggage.
Well, that it's going to be a bloody fight on both sides. There's going to be so much money on, like, there's already Randy Bryce is how many to like millions of dollars.
Yeah, but I have a feeling the floodgates will get opened by Paul Ryan's.
I think it might
pack.
Is it going to be the most expensive
style?
Is it going to be the most expensive house seat this year? One of the most, I bet.
I guess it'd be surprising if it wasn't up there.
Yeah.
Given the kind of organizational lead that Bryce has, particularly, and the connection to the current Speaker of the House, that Style.
Yeah, Brian Style.
Brian, who we talked about last week.
And he's going up against the name recognition of Paul Nehlen. Sorry.
That actually might increase Republican turnout, so to make sure it's not Paul Nehlen. Like, it's some people could see a few people showing out, like, okay, which one's not the Nazi?
You're going to fight the Nazi.
Hopefully.
Hopefully.
Maybe I'm viewing too kindly the Republicans in the first district. I don't know. So anyway, Robin Voss, so far, supposedly not in legal trouble, just more in, like, PR trouble.
Were these, like, ALEC trips?
I don't know if that was... So, in the articles that I was reading about Robin Voss, I was shocked at the number of trips he's taken. And he's like, I turn down trips all the time. As a Speaker of the House, I'm often invited on these leadership conference trips and shit like that. And they're going to, like, Europe. But it was, I don't want to give a number, but I was surprised by the number of trips that he, in his defense, he said he's taken in the past couple of years. I was like, oh my gosh, that's... and they are often paid for by these committees that are tied to conservative groups, which is why he's going on with, like, other Republican legislative leaders in other states.
Like that ALEC stuff where it's, like, all the legislators.
Yeah, and so
over.
I don't know that's specifically ALEC, but it's things like that.
Okay.
And so specifically, though, the lobbyists tied in with the speaker there and Robin Voss are payday loan lending lobbyists.
God, the worst.
And which one of them... was, like, on one of these committees, I think that paid for something from Voss. But, no, I highly recommend people, especially if you're a Wisconsin voter, you look into it. He has a list here of, here we go, Minnesota Speaker Kurt Daught, Michigan Speaker Tom Leonard, North Dakota House Majority Leader Al Carlson were at the four-day event with Republican Ohio Speaker Cliff Rosenberger last August, the Associated Press confirmed. I'm reading from the Wisconsin State Journal, but that...
Wow.
The event was sponsored and paid for by the GOPAC Education Funds Institute for Leadership Development / Circle Jerk. GOPAC works to elect Republicans to higher office.
Okay.
They defend themselves and how they're getting the money, blah, 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 blah.
This is all perfectly legal.
Among corporations attending the London event were Altria, Comcast, Walmart, and Select Management.
Wow.
Operator of the title lending business, LoanMax. Yeah. And so, there is something in here... I was reading the right article. But he had, like, a weird thing where, like this woman somehow got a little money to him, and they're all claiming it's just a between-friends wedding gift. Like, that's the level where they're like, no, that was just a wedding gift.
What?
Where they're having to defend them. Yeah. I'm surprised it hasn't blown up more. And I guess I would expect it to blow up more for him.
Mm.
But so far it hasn't. I mean, so far he's not stepping down. He's not even seemingly under intense criticism to step down that I've heard of.
Well, we've gone pretty red in this state, so can't expect there'll be too much outcry.
Yeah. I have a feeling, though, if the FBI does get involved,
then it becomes complicated.
Keep an eye out for that. We were talking about... what was next on the list? I think that was it. That was it for our closing thoughts.
Oh, okay.
Was there anything else you wanted to talk about or look forward to for the week?
Not that I can think of. Other than the Iran thing, I'm tenter hooks because of that, but...
Yeah.
That's,
that's pretty big.
I mean, I guess what to look for is, again, I'm probably going to be watching... Or watching events, not directly, but, you know, this coverage of the events to see what policies they announce or, you know, what happens over the weekend. Like, maybe they'll throw themselves in a military parade over Syria and southern Lebanon.
The fact that I have not seen reporting on sources say Trump administration leaning this way on the Iran deal...
Like
a specific, like, anonymously sourced inside story on, or maybe someone giving a speech hinting at where they're going. Like, they're really closing off their decision making beyond just kind of the crazy rhetoric he tweets out, which makes you think he's gonna go against it, but he's not done that type of thing. I mean, they've already re-upped it a couple times, right?
Yeah, uncontroversially. Well, now you got, like,
they can talk about it.
Pompeo, the guy who's most recently been in charge of the CIA, the State Department is about to become a closed black box.
Yeah. All right. Make sure to hit us up on Twitter,
iTunes, Stitcher. Yeah, please argue.
Find the podcast on many platforms. Email us at twttpod@gmail.com. All right. Have a good week. Some days it's sunny, some days it rains. Destroy the myth and we'll break our chains. Break your chains!